Welcome to this special event within the History of Art Departmental Research Seminar, and it's special pleasure to welcome to Oxford Professor Leonard Barkan, who is Class of 1943 University Professor of Comparative Literature at Princeton. Professor Barkan has taught at numerous universities, Northwestern, Michigan, NYU. He's been an actor and a director, and he's a regular contributor to publications around the world, in the USA and Italy, including on the subject of food and wine. He's published numerous important and influential works, which are known to many here, perhaps most famously to date, Unearthing the Past, Archaeology and Aesthetics in the Making of Renaissance Culture, which won prizes from the Modern Languages Association, the College Art Association, and the American Comparative Literature Association. His books also include The Gods Made Flesh, Metamorphosis and the Pursuit of Paganism, and most recently, in the work that we're here to celebrate tonight, which we have, or at least have a copy on the table, his current work, Michelangelo, A Life on Paper, which also provides the title of his talk this evening. Please welcome Professor Barkan.
Thank you. As I said to Craig, I have a background in the theater, so when I see a sellout crowd, my heart opens up, which I very rarely saw in the theater, so I'm glad I've seen it in this other lesser career of mine. It's a good place to begin. If I'm going to tell you about Michelangelo's life, perhaps I'd better start with a little bit of my own. When I was 5 years old, I was taken by my mother for some kind of toddler IQ test, where it was discovered that I could read as well as an eighth grader, but that my inability to draw pictures was so severe as to suggest slight mental retardation. And many have concurred over the subsequent decades. When I was 14, a very canny English teacher, responding to some now forgotten question from me about poems and pictures, put into my hands a monumentally important book by Jean Hagstrom called The Sister Arts. I believe at the time that I looked at the pictures, but I never read the text. In fact, 15 years later, Hagstrom hired me as his colleague at Northwestern, but that's getting ahead of my plot. During my junior year at the same high school, I made a film based on a short story by Stefan Zweig entitled The Invisible Collection, about an art collector who had gone blind and was forced to describe each etching and engraving in his collection to a dealer who had come to buy them. Unbeknownst to the old man, however, his family had actually sold off every piece of and left nothing but shiny bits of cardboard in their place. So the old man's verbal descriptions were, in fact, all that was left of the collection. And these textual strings got, as my film went along, attached to a long sequence of visual emptinesses. Suffice it to say that I seem to have had a lifelong interest in words and images, but more particularly in some sort of jagged and unstable relationship between them, like those old man's empty sheets that he so fulsomely describes. For years I've been working on these relations, focusing as well on the reciprocal connections between antiquity and the Renaissance. Essentially, I've been performing a set of deconstructive rhetorical moves upon the ever-popular ut pictura poesis, as a painting so a poem, in which I attempt to demonstrate that this enormous Gulf Stream of cultural history is less a grand scheme of analogy than a crux, a shell game, an act of evasion, an attempt to promote one discourse at the expense of another, a particularly persistent skirmish in long-running wars for cultural prestige among different aesthetic and intellectual enterprises. At the same time, to put the matter more positively, I see word and image as a kind of empowering figure that has been used to enable makers of text and makers of pictures both to theorize and to practice their craft. Now, if Michelangelo entered into this realm of my interests, it wasn't only, indeed not even largely, because he was both a great artist and a great poet, though of course that is true. Around the time I wrote Transuming Passion, which placed his drawings of Ganymede and Titius at the center of its argument, I started looking at other Michelangelo drawings. I noticed, first of all, that many of these sheets of paper also contained writing. Indeed, his writing. I also noticed that, by and large, nobody else was paying much attention to this. To cite a notable example, while Charles de Tolnay's Corpus de Disegni, and it's one of my favorite pictures, just to prove that I own this monstrous thing, indispensable and supremely authoritative in many ways, while he succeeds in documenting the minutest details of each sheet's pictorial contents, only in rare cases do the entries include transcription or discussion of the text. Take the case of this sheet in a Vatican codex of Michelangelo's autograph work. Just to give you a sense of the amount of scholarly production involved in de Tolnay, it is most of this huge double space spread that is devoted to this sheet. But it is entirely devoted to the visual sketches. The words, though occupying a considerably larger space, are not even transcribed. Things are not much different on the literary side. Enzo Noe Girardi's exhaustive edition of the poetic text, still the benchmark in the field, though desperately in need of replacement, includes every possible variant in Michelangelo's many verbal revisions, but relegates the presence of the adjacent sketches to these revisions to what, as you can see, the tiniest little footnote. From Girardi's edition, for instance, you would scarcely be aware that Michelangelo's poetic lines, Satuo nome o concetto alcuno imago non essenza del par secola morte onde l'arte e l'ingegno si dilegua, if in your name I have conceived some image, this never happens without death likewise appearing with it, which makes my powers of art and intellect fade away. You would never know from Girardi that these lines are composed indeed directly on top of a drawing, which is itself, of course, being made to fade away. Good. In short, the whole question of Michelangelo writing and drawing in the same spaces seems to have suffered from a similar sort of jagged and unstable relationship in the scholarly realm to that which these topics had occupied in my own life. But there were surprises awaiting me in my attempt to disentangle and reorder all of this matter sub specie Michelangelo. If I imagined that a work, say, like this sheet, with beautiful poetic lines, "You give me only what you already have left over and ask from me what I do not have," which are drawn in parallel to an exquisite, if faintly sketched, knee. If I imagine that they would invite the kind of inter-art analysis that one might offer up for, say, illuminated manuscripts or for emblem books. If I thought that the tools of interpreting ekphrases like the Shield of Achilles in Homer's Iliad or W.H. Auden's beautiful Musée des Beaux-Arts based on Bruegel's Fall of Icarus, if I expected to work the same tricks that I have with paintings that actually contain words, like Poussin's Arcadian Shepherds, or Rembrandt's Belshazzar's Feast, if indeed I thought that the methodological milestones in the word and image tradition from Horace's Ars Poetica to Lessing's Laocoon would be of much use, I was destined to be, longest sentence of the afternoon, I was destined to be sadly disappointed. I realized in the course of my researches that all these interrelated expressions of picture and word depended on some sort of aesthetic premeditation. Michelangelo's pages, on the other hand, with all their multiple markings, tend to be documents in artistic practice, the chance consequences of a creative mentality that spontaneously expressed itself in an unregulated mixture of visual and verbal inscriptions. They were best understood neither as essays in the tradition of cross-medium correspondence, nor as milestones on the way to the production of end-stage masterpieces. Indeed, they were best deployed as a way, and I'm putting this in particular in deliberately provocative language, to read Michelangelo's mind. And so the Ut Pictura Poesis book turned into a psychobiography. What I'm going to do this afternoon is to take you through a few of these sheets of paper so that you can judge both the method and the results. But first, a brief introduction to the archive. Michelangelo was, of course, both an artist and a writer, though in the former role, he was the most famous practitioner in the world, whereas in the latter role, he was known only to a few and published in extenso only 60 years after his death. Credited to him, and in his own hand, we have circa 500 drawings, 500 letters, and 300 poems, not to mention contracts, memos, and the equivalent of laundry lists. In every instance, there may be questions of attribution, though for our purposes, it's interesting to note that scholars tend to agree far more easily on the authentication of his handwriting than on the authentication of his draftsmanship. Whatever the precise degree of authentication, all of these activities took place on paper, often more than one kind on a single sheet. In Michelangelo's time, paper was certainly not a throwaway commodity, nor was it enormously scarce either. If there was a multiplicity of work on a single page, it may have been in part because of economy. But it also is the case that some extremely trivial efforts of both picture and word are permitted by him to occupy paper. Mere questions of materiality and price, then, cannot account for his practice. So far as writings on the drawings are concerned, just to give you a statistical sense of the phenomenon, about 25% of the drawings cohabit with text of some kind on the same sheet. And the proportion rises higher if one counts all the architectural drawings, where words are often a logical and necessary adjunct to the image. Conversely, fully one-third of the poems that we have in Michelangelo's autograph make appearances on the same pieces of paper as do drawings. And this proportion would be even higher if one were to consider all the fragmentary bits of text as though they were poems. At this point, what I'll do is take you very swiftly through a series of images just to give you a sense of the range. Sometimes the texts and images situate themselves together because Michelangelo actually meant them to be related by the fundamental parallelisms of, say, picture and caption, as in the case, particularly intriguing to me, of this extremely interesting drawing in which the artist writes three lists of foods, anchovies, tortellini, fennel soup, two breads, four breads, six breads, etc., and sketches their visual equivalents next to them. A more famous instance is this sheet of paper. You have to buy the book to know what I have to say about. These are the teasers, the trailer, saying, watch the incredible arguments and so on. Or this sheet of paper, famous sheet, devoted to painting the Sistine ceiling, where he writes a poem ridiculing his own physical position while executing the work, and next to it produces a caricature of the activity, strangely presenting himself as a heroic nude and his sacred subject matter as a kind of infantile stick figure. With these two images, you've now seen virtually all the drawings, and this will amount ultimately with the other two, one of which we'll look at in a moment, something like 2% of the total, in which this kind of straightforward caption-picture relationship can be observed. That's it for that. Beyond that, we're in more complicated territory. At the opposite extreme, let's say, there are cases where it is the merest happenstance that words and pictures are on the same sheet. Not, for me, uninteresting for that reason, but nevertheless, causally a happenstance. Consider this beautiful drawing, on the back of which, probably for the Cascina frescoes, on the back of which he has composed detailed records about his nephew's expenses, always a problem in his life. Or this resurrection drawing, which also houses bookkeeping details, themselves stretched among weird incongruities, capons, oxen, a jacket for an assistant, my father's funeral, things like that lumped together. Don't go there. Sometimes in a similar but somewhat more deliberate vein, he doodles on letters or writes letters on doodles. Here Michelangelo plays with the address side of a letter, whereas here he himself writes a letter, an important one in fact, on top of previous drawing. Sometimes it's poetry that gets juxtaposed and interlaced with sketches. In this direction, we can read a line from Dante, from this suicide canto of the Inferno, while turned upside down, what we can read is some of Michelangelo's own verse efforts. Sometimes there are messages for which drawing paper is used, or vice versa, particularly in relation to his pupils and associates. Here, have patience, love me, consolation enough, and here, draw, Antonio, draw, draw, and don't waste time, he says to a pupil who clearly has been wasting time, or at least wasting chalk, given how terrible the drawings, the copies are next to the originals that Michelangelo has set for him. Sometimes the text stands in a fairly demonstrable relationship to a project that is the endpoint of the sketching, as in this for the reading room of the Laurentian Library, especially with architectural materials, whereas in other times the incongruities are so extreme that they seem to revert to a kind of anti-ut pictura poesis of their own, as in this subject, which is probably the Annunciation, which includes a very pedestrian message about paying for a shipment of wood in the position where, indeed, traditionally, the angel's words are spelled out. And then there are the juiciest cases of all, full of randomness and incongruity, but also with greater and lesser temptations toward some sort of large-scale interpretation. Here, including such phrases as amore, dolce mio caro, prego che natura mi, amico, signor Alessandro, no bisogna. It's this kind of page that suggests to me most directly the ways in which the composite of word and image comes to represent a special kind of self-expression on the part of the artist. I have no working hypothesis for putting organically together the meticulously rendered body parts, the two profiles of possibly contrasting moods, and the tiny little, almost invisible doodles, alongside these tantalizing snippets of text about love, friendship, an unidentified Alessandro, and a bit of slightly mangled Petrarch. But another sheet, which, unlike most of these, has indeed occupied a lot of scholarly attention, will at least set us on the right path. This page in the Louvre from about 1502 appears to include drawings from two different and concurrent projects for a sculpted David. The bronze version, long in the making and now long lost, is imagined in toto on the left, while the marble version, triumphantly completed in 1504, is represented by a sketch of its right arm in a radically different scale and presumably upside down in relation to the other drawing. Much could be said about the purely compositional relationship of the two drawings, which for me leaves no doubt that there is a compositional relationship rather than one dictated by mere questions of space on the page. My concern for the moment, however, is one of the pieces of writing on the page. Davide con la fromba e io con l'arco, Michelangelo. David with his slingshot and I with my arco. Whatever that means exactly, but generally translated appropriately as bow. In my book, I spend quite a few pages considering what sort of bow this might be, how it might be like or unlike David's weapon, or some mixture of alike and unlike, and the ways in which a confrontational relationship between Davide and Io may itself derive from the biblical story about the confrontation between David and Goliath, or between the Israelites and the Philistines. Is Michelangelo the slender young David up against the artistic establishment? Is he the wielder of some subtle, almost musical weapon like David's, other accoutrements, as opposed to the kind of brute force represented by the Philistine? Is he the sculptor up against the giant, which was actually the name widely given to the huge piece of marble out of which the David statue was carved? And what of the fact that uniquely in this version of the story, Goliath doesn't get represented at all, whereas David becomes a giant? For answers to these and other questions, you can buy the book. What's important for today's argument, which is available at Blackwell's at a discount, I'm told. I don't know why I have that popped into my head, but there it is. What is important for today's argument is that Michelangelo has drawn two Davids on this sheet, and that whether previously, concurrently, or subsequently, he has, first, engaged in some complex introspection about his own stake in this piece of artistic production, and second, he has composed a record of that introspection, whether for his own viewing or for that of others, and third, he has sealed that communicative act by, in effect, signing his name, which, as it happens, he is famous for not doing on virtually every finished artwork he ever produced. What we have here, then, is a smoking gun for the proposition that Michelangelo's sheets of paper were sites where his meditations in relation to artistic practice expressed themselves. What is extreme, almost unique, about this Louvre sheet, and it goes with that nearly unique signature, is not just that Michelangelo is introspecting, and not just that he's recording his introspection, but that he knows he is performing this act of writing his interior life into the picture. If we're looking for the richest sort of auto-revelations, however, we may do better to catch him in the act when he is not quite so self-aware about the procedure. The very beautiful drawings on both sides of this page have caused much dispute as to subject matter, purpose, and date. What can be said for certain is that they consist of three different groupings featuring the Madonna, that all of them show the influence of Leonardo, and that whatever their precise destination, if indeed they had a destination, and they may not have. They probably date from the opening years of the 16th century. Besides the extraordinary finish of the pen work, what's perhaps most distinctive here is that both sides include some form of squaring off lines that apparently make reference to the external outline of future finished work. On the recto, these lines seem merely functional, and they're accompanied by a cryptic autograph notation that probably refers to some projected transfer of the design to another form. The rectangle on the verso, however, is a representational part of the design itself, creating a sense of depth out of which the Madonna and Child emerge in what may be relief or may be, in fact, fully three-dimensional sculptural form. Suffice it to say that this sheet is to an unusual degree geared toward a final product, and particularly on the verso here, that gives the drawing a special sort of monumentality, almost as though it were the final product, like a presentation drawing, except it's 30 years before Michelangelo made any presentation drawings, and then he did very few. He did not leave the drawing in that form, however. Sometime later, he inscribed 24 lines of verse in elegant script and without correction, the first eight with a firmer hand and in slightly larger letters than the rest. Beneath that, and presumably still later, he composed some alternative lines, not all of them decipherable. The body of the text is laid down in such a fashion that its right edge finishes precisely at the point where the fictive marble slab begins. Clearly, those 24 lines do not represent a working draft, as we often see on these sheets. Rather, they are formally inscribed in this space on the page. Otherwise, obviously, the lines wouldn't all end at exactly the right place. You can begin lines in a straight spot, but you cannot by accident end them there. Whatever the artist originally chose to represent here, say a Madonna who opens her cloak in the style of a Misericordia or a Caritas to reveal or protect a Christ child who's absorbed in reading a book, the whole thing inside some sort of marble frame, whatever it was, the ensemble was subsequently expanded to include a lengthy piece of writing that, depending how you look at it, may simply be adjacent to the pictorial sketch on the page, may live on the page, as it were, or it may be imagined as actually inscribed in the space of the fictional monument itself. Whatever the rabbit duck possibilities here, the content of the text bears close attention. You have a face sweeter than grape must, and it looks like a snail seems to have passed across it. It shines so much. And it is more beautiful than a turnip, teeth white as parsnips, so that you would charm even the Pope, and eyes the color of medicinal treacle, and hair whiter and blonder than leeks. So I shall die if you do not come to my help. So if I stress the formal aspects of this design, it's in order to establish just how complex, not to say bizarre, the relation between the drawing and verse-making has become. You may have already noticed that an element of irony and self-irony appears in some of these word-image combinations, like the list of foods and the painting of the Sistine ceiling, both of which in some sense are jocose. But here, the incongruity, in this case, not just between picture and word, but also between sacred visual representation and verbal low comedy, is at its most radical. The poem itself, after all, is in the mode of mock encomium. It's a form that depends historically on a parodic relation to predecessor texts, in this case, the Petrarchan blason, or the list of the beloved's beauties. Michelangelo, as it happens, operates at a second level of relation to his predecessors, since he patterns his poem with uncharacteristic fidelity after comic verse by Berni Burchiello and notably Lorenzo de' Medici. In each of these cases, the jokes depend on the intensity of the speaker's engagement with the high literary tradition, that is to say, the careful reading of Petrarch, at the same time as the same speaker turns out to have a preposterously earthbound field of reference with which to build his glorious erotic similitudes. But Michelangelo is able to go his comic predecessors one better because he is possessed of an additional instrument whereby loftiness may be deflated with mockery. To inscribe these ludicrous lines next to what is not only a Madonna and Child, but also the sculpture of a Madonna and Child, and with the Christ Child's head buried in a book, no less, is to add yet one more dimension, literally, to the complex gap between the heroic and the prosaic. From the point of view of self-revelation, in the style of David with his slingshot and I with my bow, perhaps the most important thing is that this parodic move enables Michelangelo to step into the poetic persona in a new way. When Lorenzo de' Medici, in Magnifico himself, who probably composed the poem in question, but may not have, but was believed to have, anyway, when he composes the long Polyphemus-like love monologue of the boorish Barbarino, the joke is that the real poet could not possibly be further from the bumpkin whose voice he assumes. For Michelangelo, as it turns out, the alternative identity is a little closer to home. He concludes the formal verses with, "If it were possible for me to have blocks of stone, we understand, I'd here today make incredible things." When he concludes with that, in other words, he adds a clumsy boast about artistic accomplishment to all the poem's other awkward love language, and on a sheet of paper that is probably for some considerable period of time represented the remains of some uncompleted project. In effect, the page has become a sort of skewed mise en abîme in which the maker of both picture and word is outed as someone whose every ambition is doomed to laughable disappointment. The idea of accomplishing cose incredibili remains in the realm of unpublished text and uncompleted statuary. And the goal of self-scrutiny and self-representation is most decidedly achieved by placing these visual and verbal marks in such curious proximity on the page. One step further toward the unconscious. The recto of yet another Louvre sheet represents one of many relatively stable efforts at a fully realized figure on paper. Though its central Apollo Belvedere-style nude has clearly been reworked and another classical figure added. But it's the verso that turns into a maelstrom of disegno. The work there began as a tracing of the recto's principal figure, but beyond that point, all hell breaks loose. Crowded into a small space, there are no fewer than 9 additional drawings, executed either with pencil or various forms of pen and ink, or both, and in all 4 possible orientations of the page. With the tracing in upright position, Michelangelo drew a slave-like figure with upraised arm, produced in quick outline, as well as a lightly hatched winged Puto's head. And you'll have to work your own Where's Waldo and finding all of these, as I've had to do. Turning the page 90 degrees to the right, we find a finely drawn male midsection with a suggestion of upper body and legs. In a similar style, he sketches a profile head, and beneath it another, possibly similar head, so faint that even its medium is difficult to determine, and it won't be visible in this form. With the next turning, we can see a Puto, complete to the ankles, in ink outline, its posture reminiscent of the Laocoon younger's son, and, virtually invisible in what is now the lower left corner, a reclining figure, perhaps in the style of a river god. The final turning gives us a heavily outlined left leg and a bearded man wearing an elaborately plumed hat, both very carefully drawn in ink. And, of course, I do this in an order, but we have no idea precisely in what order he originally produced it. In one sense, then, we are seeing a dizzying range of inventions, while in another sense it is clear that many of these fragments are recurrent efforts to sketch a sampling of particular body parts, torso, arm, profile, head, that appear on many other of the artist's contemporary sheets. Then in a third sense, whether we emphasize similarity or difference among these images, we can only wonder at their all but monstrous interrelation. A giant leg that traverses a torso while a smaller torso blots out an ankle, one man's feather hat that tickles another man's headdress, a face that nuzzles testicles. In the midst of all this, perhaps the most surprising set of markings on the page are laid down in what turns out to be a largely undisturbed bit of space. The words appear in a quite elegant handwriting. L'ardente nodo ov'io fu d'ora in ora, cotanto anni 21 ardendo preso, morte disciolse, ne già mai tal peso provai, ne credo c... The fiery knot I was caught in, hour by hour, burning for a count of 21 years, death has untied. Nor have I ever felt such a weight, nor do I believe that man... And he breaks. It is an almost verbatim rendering of Petrarch's Rime 271, one of the poems written after Laura's death. The sonnet goes on, in a rather curious vein, to announce the death of another woman whom the speaker loved. But Michelangelo breaks off just before the poem moves in that direction. And his quotation is the more interesting because his one mistake, anni 21 ardendo, he writes, for anni 21 interi in the original, that one mistake brings the text in line with a different instance of Petrarch counting the years of his love in Rime 364. Paradoxically, it is Michelangelo's misquotation, his pulling of one Petrarch poem into another, that corroborates his deep familiarity, as all the contemporary biographers attest, with the Petrarchan poetic corpus. The text itself, to be sure, is rich in associative significance. Even the very young Michelangelo, it turns out, is highly conscious of time, aging, and death, focusing, as he does frequently, on the later sonnets, the In Morte sonnets of Rime Sparse. At approximately age 30, the artist could not possibly possess 21 years' worth of erotic memories. Maybe not, anyway. I couldn't. Petrarch, even now I have trouble. Petrarch provides them vicariously. But what happens in this ventriloquizing transfer? Everything on the page is a fragment. When we repeatedly see truncated or disjointed efforts at drafting body parts, just to pick a bunch of instances where that happens, we tend to conclude, rightly, that Michelangelo is facing challenges, aesthetic challenges, technical challenges, psychological challenges, or all of the above, in regard to these pieces of representation. The same goes for the textual fragment. Michelangelo plucks out lines from his reading memory, undertakes to transcribe what he recollects, misremembers, and then breaks off just short of completing the first stanza. The slide from one poem to another, via the borrowing of Ardere, tells us that his memory is creating its own filing system to flag a particular kind of passionately melancholy retrospection, and in the process eliding a crucial distinction in Petrarch between recovering from Laura's death because of a new love, which is the case in one of these poems, and recovering from her death because God wills it so, which is the case in the other of these poems. More revealing still is the truncation, apparently in mid-word, in the lines that are otherwise so meticulously remembered. Michelangelo has stopped writing, or his memory has failed him, and after all it's a poem about memory, precisely where Petrarch has made a rather surprising move. Petrarch reviews the 21-year-long bond, nodo, of loving Laura that death has now dissolved, and he declares that he has never experienced such a heavy weight, nor, he says, does he believe that... dot, dot, dot. This is where Michelangelo breaks off. At this point, doubtless, an astute, disinterested, and new critically trained reader, noticing Di Scholze and Peso, untied and weight, might find it quite logical that the statement of belief, what he didn't believe, with which the stanza ends, is the proposition that man cannot die of grief, which is what Petrarch in fact says, ne credo quam di dolor mora. In other words, that the dissolving of the bond and the lifting of the weight point toward recovery from the sorrow both of loving and losing Laura. A recovery that Petrarch will pursue, precisely in the poem that Michelangelo mixes up with this one, in the direction of serene heavenly acceptance. But when I read the 3.5 lines that precede the dot, 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 particularly in relation to the hundreds of Petrarchan agonizing lines that precede them, I entertain an expectation quite contrary to where Petrarch actually goes. That is, I expect the speaker to say that he will die of grief, a conclusion that is encouraged by the syntactic parallelism between the two ne, or nor, clauses, the first of which speaks to such Dantean suffering, leading us to suppose that the second will intensify rather than diminish this expression of pain. Michelangelo is stuck at this crossroads of possibilities, which is actually a multiple crossroads, not only before the question of whether one can recover from grief, but also whether the inability to die of grief should be understood as a good thing or a bad thing. Petrarch, for his part, complicates that question with an equally ambiguous recourse to a second beloved, which leads him into the weird territory of suggesting that Laura's death was a piece of good fortune, since it trained him to have an easier time with the death of her successor in his affection. Go figure, you say in New York. Michelangelo can't go down that particular road. He is unable to pursue Petrarchan role-playing so far as to hypothesize a second beloved, or even at this point a first, but he is able to move forward from this verbal rupture in a manner that Petrarch did not have at his disposal. As in many other cases, I hesitate to claim a precise temporal or causal relation between words and images, though here the ink does look quite similar. But however these two sets of markings manage to find themselves in proximity, the interrupted Petrarch lines next to the winged Amorino angel, right below them, barely visible, take my word for it, seem to converge on questions of death, love, and the hereafter. It's a decidedly jagged connection, of course. Once again, hardly a case of ut pictura poesis. But it will lead us to one final page, where I think we can assert the kind of logic that may animate my material psychobiography. A couple of decades later in Michelangelo's career, though dates are rarely certain, when writing poetry began to occupy him as much, or at any rate as intensely, as the making of visual art, he works on a set of terza rima verses that reveal, in fact, close indebtedness to the Petrarch sonnet that he had stopped in the middle of inscribing amid the drawings on the last sheet we talked about. He has at this time had the real experience of the death of a loved one, perhaps his brother Bonarotto, and now he ventures on precisely the territory that lay beyond his reach when he copied Rime 271. Troppo dolor vol pur chi campe viva. Excess of pain makes me still survive and live. And from that point, his language turns yet more Petrarchan. Cruel, I'll just read the English, cruel mercy and merciless grace left me alive and cut you off from me, breaking but not extinguishing our bond. And not only did they deprive me of your memory, once again, the ellipsis. Even though he seems to be composing something like a fair copy, one more time he breaks off in the middle of a heavily charged syntactic unit. There is no version of this version of the text, and so we cannot guess what else crudel pietate and spietate mercede might do to him besides, not only the deprived of memory, but what else they might do to him besides. Indeed, by creating the double oxymoronic subject, cruel mercy and merciless grace, Michelangelo has further complicated the question that was left hanging in the Petrarch transcription as to whether this extra consequence of grief was going to be a positive one or a negative one. That we are here in some territory of deep inward uncertainty is confirmed by the fact that this isn't the only ellipsis on the sheet. We've been looking at the side that is designated as the recto, but previously, on the verso, he's made a much rougher attempt at the same poem or the same feelings. It begins, as does the later version, with an extravagant pathetic fallacy about the way his sighs, so spiri, would have dried up the world's bodies of water were it not that his tears have filled them up again with liquid. This is why he may not be the greatest poet who ever lived, but there are a lot of people, he sort of is part of inventing that, he has a lot to answer for in that kind of conceit making. But then he gets bogged down with a conceit about the individual who falls in love, chi s'innamora, and therefore meets death with pleasure, or perhaps does not meet death with pleasure, and again he crosses out precisely on this question of pleasure or not pleasure. And so he goes through various cancelled possibilities, and they are followed by something much clearer, presumably designed to replace them. Così la violente aspra pena che porto al cor di te me tanto cara. And there it is again. So the violent and bitter pain that I feel in my heart on your account is to me so dear. At which point, yet again, the writing breaks off. By this time, this should not be a surprise. It is the clearest and most straightforward account of what has evidently been a great anguish for Michelangelo, namely the possibility that he actually enjoys suffering. That, in other words, he might indeed benefit from the death of someone he loves, as Petrarch had, for different reasons, curiously proposed in his own situation. But what is as interesting as the glimpse into Michelangelo's unspoken mental state is the break itself. It's difficult, in the case of the Petrarch poem we looked at a few moments ago, to be sure about the relation between the writing and the image-making. But here, the nature of that relation is clearer. He does not finish the thought that tanto cara introduces. Instead of revealing quanto cara, he chooses to distance himself from the experience of writing and reading. With what appears to be the same pen and the same ink, and of course the same right hand, he composes a portrait of his own left hand. With which he has laid down, sharply bent at the wrist, on or near the other half of the partially empty page. And that page doesn't look empty because we're seeing the writing from the other side, but that part of the page is empty. The index finger, slightly truncated by the final word, points to that troublesome love of suffering, right there with cara. Michelangelo has, in effect, recreated the sign of the manicure, the picture of the pointing finger that had for centuries in both manuscript and print given special emphasis to the written word, but the kind of emphasis that mere words themselves could not provide. In this case, the image arises in the silence, blankets the space, and delivers what the text cannot itself deliver, cannot bring itself to deliver, a self-portrait which, but for the necessary imperfection of being the left rather than the right hand, would stand as pictorial metonymy for that inward capacity which makes both images and words. But it remains in mathematical terms an irrational relation. There is no handy ratio here, no ut that can map the transit between poesis and pictura, as between, say, the bread, wine, and fish and their pictorial equivalents on the menu page, or even between the fictive statue of the Madonna and the auto-referential burlesque that mocks any ambition to produce such a work. It is fundamentally the incommensurability of language and picture that counts as his deepest, most generative force. So, if there is so much enigma here, how is it and by what means do I believe I can read Michelangelo's mind? We have, just to anchor ourselves in data, a particular historical individual. With some 500 of his personal letters, hundreds of ricordi in his handwriting, and almost as many first-person poems, two biographies written by close associates of his, a sizable number of extant contracts, numerous transcriptions of his conversation, as usual not reliable, and at least 1,000 letters to him or documents in which he is mentioned, Michelangelo is, I would venture to say, the most extensively archived early modern European who's not a king, pope, or saint. It's not only the volume of the documentation, but also the nature of the written record as regards Renaissance personhood. The fact is that from almost the earliest moments we can trace, Michelangelo was fixated on himself and quite conscious of his work as auto-referential. And he possessed a kind of megalomania that not only caused him to see the external world as a projection of himself, but also inspired his contemporaries to partake of that vision. And so I take it as possible to whittle away at the methodological boundaries between biography and oeuvre. In effect, I take permission from Vasari, among others, to consider the life itself as a work of art, with the caveat that the life of the artist is not so much a narrative constructed from many sources and given a reality status against which the artistic production can be made to perform its imaginative work. Rather, the life of the artist is best embodied as a sheaf of papers, which, however public its ultimate diffusion, and after all, the very fact that we have these sheets speaks to their public diffusion, turns out to have been born, for the most part, as private, supremely self-referential, and filled with all the forms of expression and repression that are characteristic of internal life. I choose to consider them as Michelangelo's waking dreams, the records of his unconscious, and to cite another relevant Freudian formulation, the psychopathology of his everyday life. But as I reflect on my own practice, I realize that I do privilege a certain subset of this archive. If Michelangelo proves to have been a radically restless maker of marks on paper, as we can see in among hundreds of examples, it ought to be made clear that sometimes, in fact, he broke off words with other words. And, of course, sometimes he broke off pictures with other pictures. Why then, or so I would ask if I were writing a nasty review of my own book, should the anomalous presence of the Petrarch lines be any more revealing than the anomalous juxtapositions on the same sheet that are merely pictorial? Well, despite all my disclaimers, it appears that my project turns out to have its own investment in ut pictura poesis, and all those other assertions about a poem being a speaking picture and a picture being a silent poem. I suppose that is because in this whole field of fissure and fragmentation, I find the incommensurability of language and picture to be Michelangelo's deepest, most generative enigma. And I embrace wholeheartedly the metaphor that his great biographer J.A. Simmons used when he called Michelangelo's drawings the hieroglyphs of his mind. I'm not certain that Simmons was referring to the words on the pictures or the words as pictures, but whatever he had in mind, the ideographic metaphor of Simmons captures for me everything about the inextricability of text and image, about the dream of an expressive system that might be picture and word at once, and about the ultimate undecipherability of the invisible spaces of inspiration where they are conjoined. If it turns out I'm turning my own pages, like Stefan Zweig's hapless blind collector, it's because I am still trying to put together the visible and the linguistic. And I'm still faltering in the unbridgeable gap between them. Thank you.